Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's always nice to take a little time away, so we did. A special report from the Aspen Ideas Festival on the broadcast today. Also, will somebody please make up their minds about what the economy is going to do? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the new Harvard Business Review. The July-August issue is on newsstands now, featuring an in-depth interview with Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 8th of July today. And you'll notice I've abandoned the friendly confines of the Frank Stanton Studios for a couple of days up in the mountains. The Aspen Ideas Festival is exactly that, a place and a chance to talk about some of the big ideas of the day. Sometimes those big ideas are on the serious side, like this one from economic historian Neil Ferguson just the other day.
The financial crisis that began in the summer of 2007, that has accelerated a fundamental shift in the economic balance of power.
Sometimes they are ideas about innovations, economic or otherwise, like a little thing you might have heard of called Twitter and co-founder Biz Stone.
The open exchange of information can and will have a positive impact, not just on that local level, but globally, and that people are basically good, and if you give them a tool to do good, they will.
As it happens, we're going to have more with Biz Stone and his Twitter co-founder Evan Williams a bit later in the broadcast. But the actual news of this Thursday begins with, drumroll please, yes, the economy, both ends of it, as consumers keep on trying to figure out how they feel about things, a topic we will get to in a minute. Policymakers in Washington are trying to do the same thing, keep on giving the economy a kick in the pants or pull back and get the deficit under control. And when I say policymakers here, by the way, what I'm really talking about is the Federal Reserve. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has the story.
The Fed dropped interest rates on short-term bank loans to virtually zero nearly 2 years ago, and they've kept rates there ever since. After each meeting, Fed members promised their loose monetary policy will remain for the foreseeable future. But with the economy sputtering again, some wonder whether banks and businesses need assurances that those favorable interest rates will be around for years. Former Fed Governor Lawrence Meyer says the Fed could use more specific language.
It has to do something that they have said they would never do, and that is to make an unconditional promise not to tighten for a very long time. No central bank wants to do that.
Because it would tie the Fed's hands if the economy suddenly took off and generated too much inflation. Another idea would be to inject more money into the banking system. The Fed could encourage bank lending by buying more treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities. That's what the Fed did during the depths of the credit crisis. But former regional Fed Vice Chairman Gerald O'Driscoll says that didn't stimulate much lending.
It has given the banks a no-lose, no-risk, almost no-risk play, which is to borrow at near-zero interest rates and buy 10-year treasuries.
Which means banks have no incentive to lend that money to consumers. Both O'Driscoll and Meyer say the central bank can't do much about what's ailing the economy right now. For example, what can the Fed do about potential credit defaults in Europe? So for now, both Fed members expect the central bank to sit tight. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You work your way down the economy from the Fed, and you get many, many layers down to you and me. And what exactly we are going to do when the economy does eventually come back. Will we be frugal and responsible and forever changed, or just itching to start living beyond our means again? Here's Jeff Horwich.
Okay, this is your brain 3 years ago. Maybe one of those Visa commercials where everyone's dancing around swiping credit cards. Ah, good times. And this is your brain on recession.
There's got to be more ways to save. I really want a cup of coffee, but I can't justify stopping and getting a cup of coffee.
That's actually Leah Ingram's brain. She started the blog Suddenly Frugal after selling her house to get out of debt.
What I'm hoping is that this whole experience of conscious frugalness makes me a smarter financial person in the long run.
There are hints the recession may be rewiring us into more responsible consumers. Retail sales figures out today show shoppers continued to hold back last month, and they're sticking to the bargain bin. And they're laying off the plastic. Credit card delinquencies are the lowest in 8 years. Julie Zachariasen is with LSS Financial Counseling in Mankato, Minnesota. She says the sheer number of people forced into credit counseling means more people indoctrinated into a frugal lifestyle.
More than ever before, I find folks that are just saying it's okay to recycle and repurpose things and to barter.
Retail consultant Howard Davidowitz believes our thrifty habits are here to stay because the crappy economy is here to stay.
Living standards in our country can never be the same. The consumer is scared out of their wits.
But at some point, we're likely to get those wits back. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in the economy, namely the financial sector, Wells Fargo is going to retire a couple of stagecoaches. All right, a whole branch of its business, to be clear. The fourth largest bank in the country is closing 600 or so retail outlets. The company also said it's going to stop selling subprime loans. Marketplace's Eve Tro has more.
Wells Fargo Financial wrote loans for customers in mostly low-income neighborhoods and sold those loans to investors. Not many buyers these days. Banking consultant Bert Ely says today's announcement formalizes the bank's steady withdrawal from subprime lending.
It can take a while for a large company to finally decide what to do with a particular business.
Ely says that decision may have been hastened by looming financial reforms.
Wells, as well as other companies, may feel that the regulations are just going to make certain forms of lending not very profitable.
Wells Fargo says it will still make loans through its branches and mortgage offices. Chris Kulka with the Center for Responsible Lending says many areas that had a Wells Fargo financial office didn't have a branch.
If they close the only presence that they have in some of these communities, it actually starts to make it harder to get access to financial services.
He says Wells Fargo is distancing itself from subprime customers on the ground and keeping them off its bottom line. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, another winner. That is two in a row, gang. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The Veterans Administration decided today it's going to make it easier for soldiers diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder to get benefits. The VA is going to relax some of its strict rules that have buried a lot of veterans in paperwork. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan are going to be eligible, as will Vietnam-era vets, still trying to prove they qualify. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
It was decades after his tour as a platoon commander in Vietnam that Ted Balzerini got his diagnosis from the Department of Veterans Affairs. They said he had post-traumatic stress disorder. Then came the hard part, getting that same department to give him disability benefits. After 6 months of filing paperwork and waiting, Balzerini got approved. His reaction?
This can't be true. I couldn't believe it when it came through.
Balzerini was one of the lucky ones, he says. There are about 150,000 veterans diagnosed with PTSD by doctors from the VA. But an analysis of the records show that only half of those vets have been approved for disability checks. The VA is now changing their eligibility rules as soon as next week. No longer will you have to prove that your PTSD came from the war.
With our veterans, there's a presumption that they're not telling the truth.
Aaron Glantz is the author of two books about Iraq, including The War Comes Home. He said veterans that apply for benefits have had to specify the exact events, like a mortar attack, that caused their trauma.
You need to be interviewed by a claims examiner who would try to poke holes in your story.
Advocates say the old rules left out thousands of service members who did not serve in active combat, but suffered trauma nonetheless. Congressional analysts estimate the new rules could cost the government an additional $5 billion over the next several years as more veterans return home and sign up. I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Think back to the top of the program for a minute. Those two stories about the Fed and consumers. You roll in what the president said today in a speech in Kansas City about the economy, that there are, and I'm quoting him here, hard days ahead, and the prospect of a sustained recovery does seem to be in some doubt. State and local governments are feeling that economic unease, and that is creating another wave of layoffs. From WNIJ in Northern Illinois, Mike Moan has more now on public safety payrolls.
On the west side of Rockford, Illinois, fire station number 8 is responding to its first call of the day. Pretty soon, this particular station will likely shut down. It's part of a cost-cutting move proposed by city leaders. The plan calls for laying off up to 20 firefighters total. Fire Chief Derek Bergston says it's a difficult choice, but he says Rockford city officials have already trimmed so much they had nowhere else to cut. Bergston says neighborhood residents will certainly notice this spending reduction.
Taking a station out of an area creates a longer response time, so there will be an impact on the level of service provided.
Adding insult to injury, Bergston says the city doesn't have any money to buy new fire equipment.
We have some of the oldest equipment in the state. We still have two 1976 ladder trucks that we're using on a daily basis.
Police departments are also feeling the pain. In the Chicago suburb of Naperville, the city recently laid off a handful of officers. Vince Clark heads the police union there. He says most outreach programs have also been eliminated.
Our internet program, you know, telling kids how to stay away from predators, homeowners associations, you know, all the different community programs that we have interaction with.
Christiana McFarland is with the National League of Cities. She says these examples show just how desperate city governments are.
Cities at this point are already down to their bare bones. Some are taking unprecedented measures to balance their budgets. We know that 1 in 4 city officials are reporting that they're making cuts to public safety.
McFarland says there's another growing problem for local governments, paying retired police officers and firefighters with less revenue.
Cities nationwide are feeling the brunt of pension costs. It's a huge drag on many local budgets.
That sentiment is shared by Rockford's mayor. In a guest editorial for the city's newspaper, he urged Illinois lawmakers to enact reform when it comes to public safety pensions. He says it's a tragic irony they might have to lay off existing firefighters to help pay benefits for retired public safety personnel. From Rockford, Illinois, I'm Mike Moan for Marketplace.
Coming up, making sense out of random blather.
Unlike the telephones, because the vast majority of tweets are public, you can derive really interesting meaning out of these what individually look like trivial mutterings.
Biz Stone and Evan Williams coming up, the guys behind Twitter. But first, let's do the numbers. Good retail sales news drove stocks up for the third day in a row. The Dow Industrials jumped 1.2%, 120 points, closed at 10,138 today. The NASDAQ popped up 0.75%, 15 points, 2175. The number there, the S&P 500 rose almost 0.9%, that is 9 points higher, ended at 1,070. Retailers did brisk business on that sales news. JCPenney zipped up more than 6.5% today. Saks sashayed up more than 2%. Macy's rang up a nearly 3% gain. H&R Block took a tumble on news that its CEO quit. The tax filing company was shredded in trading today, ending down 8%. Markets in Europe ended higher. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.3%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com/market. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale trade for the month of May. The National Governors Association begins its annual meeting in Boston. And musician Courtney Love turns 46. Did you hear? Hole is together and back on tour. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl from the Aspen Ideas Festival today up in Aspen, Colorado. And here's a little travel tip for those who might never have had the chance to get up here. Summertime in Aspen, even better than winter. Not as cold and way, way easier to appreciate the amazing great outdoors. A lot of what's happening in Aspen this week, though, is inside at the Ideas Festival. There's been a whole series of panels on digital life and the new economy, how living in a world of ones and zeros is changing how we live, everything from how we get our news and information to how much money we carry in our pockets. Janet Babin explains how mobile pay programs via social media or through your cell phone is changing the way we do business.
Will Stefega knows the mobile technology space pretty well. It's his job as an analyst at IDC to cover tech trends. But even he was not prepared for all the cell phones he saw on a recent trip to India.
They've chosen to purchase mobile phones before they even have basic plumbing services. Guys living in a hut somewhere without any running water or anything, you think, oh my God, but then you see he has a Nokia device or a Samsung device.
And Stefega says people are coming up with innovative ways to use those devices. Farmers can check their cell phones to find a nearby market that'll fetch the highest price for their crops. Some employees get paychecks by cell phone. In a twist on the typical flow of technology, these mobile phone innovations have made their way from developing countries to the U.S. instead of the other way around. Take the mobile payment service OboPay. The idea for the Redwood City, California firm actually came from Africa, where many people have cell phones, but relatively few have bank accounts. That's true in many parts of the world, says OboPay's marketing chief, David Schwartz.
There's now 4 billion people in the world who have a cell phone, but there's only about 1.5 billion people who have a bank account today or any access to financial services.
So in developing countries, OboPay acts like a mobile bank. You can transfer money from a prepaid account through a cell phone. In the U.S., OboPay links your phone to your bank account through a PIN number. Lots of new ways to move money around are emerging that take some control away from banks and credit card companies. There's Checkout by Amazon and Google Checkout that offer e-commerce retailers alternative ways to get paid. Devices from startups like Square let anyone with a smartphone take a credit card payment. A company called TwitPay links your Twitter account to your PayPal account. And Will Stefego with IDC says there's another elephant in the mobile pay room.
We know from patent filings that Apple is really very, very interested in using its assets to enable mobile payments.
As in bypassing your credit card to purchase directly from the iTunes store. All these new payment methods could chip away at the system banks and credit card companies have in place. Mobile pay could level the playing field, especially for smaller merchants. The fees levied on businesses to accept credit card transactions can be expensive. Typical mobile pay services usually cost about half what the credit card companies charge per transaction. OboPay's David Schwartz says since the economic downturn, many of the company's new customers are smaller mom-and-pop operations.
People are using the service for things like running their daycares, piano teachers being able to, or tutors being able to get access to funds right away.
A study out this week from the Pew Internet and American Life Project found that as of May of this year, 11% of cell phone owners said they'd purchased a product using their phone. This was the first year the Pew survey even asked people about buying stuff with their mobile phones. But there are some challenges to mobile pay. Michael Gartenberg with the Altimeter Group says the security risk of handling these new money transactions can be enormous.
It's harder than it looks because there has to be an awful lot of trust going on in a lot of different places. Trust from the consumer side, from the banking side, trust in terms of security and privacy that make this stuff work.
So even though it's inching closer, the day of the fully digital wallet could still be years off. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
Okay, so now we're at the point of the broadcast where I eat a little crow. I have been shy about saying on the program that I don't really get Twitter. Other social media, sure. Facebook, I'm right there with you. But 140 characters worth of here's what I'm doing right now? To be honest, I needed some help with that. And you know what the really interesting part is? So too, as you're about to hear, did the guys who started Twitter in the first place. Usually, when we would talk to CEOs as one of our conversations from the corner office, it's actually from their corner office, or at least the conference room next door, maybe. Today, though, something a little bit different. Evan Williams and Biz Stone, the Twitter guys, are here in Aspen this week for the Ideas Festival. They've done a couple of panel discussions on innovation. Small things like, I don't know, 140-character messages turning into big ideas. And when we talked, Evan Williams said that 9 months after Twitter launched, it was still mainly being used by web types until the South by Southwest conference in 2008.
It's a very social conference, so there's panels and there's content, and people would talk about, you know, what panel they were at, but they'd also talk about what parties they were going to. Yeah. And that was the critical piece of information, and you could see, we put some screens up in the hallways that showed who was there and what people were saying, and it just energized this event, and it brought this whole new layer of information and richness to it.
And so you get out of South by Southwest in 2008, Biz, and then what do? You come home and you say, you know what, we got something.
Yeah, we were certainly renewed and excited about what we were working on, and it was starting to grow faster because we got a lot of attention out of that festival. And so we started to grow pretty good in 2008. Other things started happening around the world that, again, were just affirmations of our work. A student from UC Berkeley traveled to Egypt to photograph activism, and he kept missing the protests. And he asked his friends in Egypt, how do you know where to protest? And they said, we're using Twitter. So he gets on it, and he makes the next protest, but he gets arrested by Egyptian police. He managed to tap out a one-word tweet, which was arrested. And when that information got back to his friends in Berkeley, they took it seriously, went to the dean. Dean went to the lawyer. Lawyer went to the consulate. A few hours later, another one-word tweet, freed.
All right, so let me ask you this, though. For all the real tangible news and information and good that comes out of this system that you guys created, what do you do when 99% of what's on there is my cat just coughed up a hairball, right? I mean, what do you do?
Sure. There's two parts to that. One, my cat coughed up a hairball was important to someone who, you know, the person who wrote it. And maybe they'll occasionally write things that are important to more people. But the real answer is if you listen to 100% of the phone calls that went on, you'd find out that people talk about what seems like pretty trivial stuff amongst themselves. And unlike the telephones, because the vast majority of tweets are public, you can derive really interesting meaning out of these what individually look like trivial mutterings.
Biz? Yeah, and that's another answer to your original question of how do you get to this good information that's certainly in there. And that falls on us to create discovery mechanisms, filtering mechanisms, way of surfacing information that's relevant to you, where you are, when you need it.
And it also helps, not coincidentally, to play into the business aspect of this thing, which is how you guys make money. Because, you know, for all the fun and good you're having, you're not in this for nothing, right, Biz?
That's right, yeah. We certainly believe that the open exchange of information can have a positive global impact. And sometimes we're looked at as, like, you know, hippies. But
which is funny, because you don't look like it.
We believe that's true. And we also believe that you can make a great business out of it. So we've just recently begun launching our monetization platform, Promoted Tweets and Promoted Trends, which allow businesses to, you know, surface their tweets in front of more people.
So Promoted Tweets and Promoted Trends, is that another way of saying search on Twitter, right, Ev?
Yeah, it's part of search, and that's where they surface. So Promoted Tweets is simply a tweet that would surface in search, and we take it out of the chronological order and put it on top. And trends is a feature of the site where we surface what a lot of people are talking about. The first one we did was for Toy Story 3, obviously a big event. A lot of people are talking about the movie. Disney Pixar wanted to make sure their people really saw that it was up there. And so they promoted Toy Story 3 as a promoted trend. People click on it, they get its search results and see what everybody's saying about this movie.
By the way, not a bad box office opening.
I would say. Right? I mean, you guys picked a good thing to
or they did.
Oh, yes, it was Twitter. Well, I mean, that brings up another way that this thing gets used, right? I mean, not only is it news and not only is it social events and stuff like that, but, you know, you guys can play a hand in the fortune of movies, right? Somebody sees a movie, it's a dud, you pull out your phone, you tweet that this thing stinks, and then it eventually gets out there, and you guys have killed Hollywood.
Well, we haven't killed Hollywood. This is a thing that people have dubbed the Twitter effect, and all it really is doing is speeding up what's been happening forever, which is word of mouth.
Isn't that the last thing we need today? Life is busy enough and fragmented enough that really we could all just do to step back. And
I think we do want to address that. We have an explicit goal to make Twitter an antidote to information overload, not a source of it. And it's not there yet, but that's one of our big long-term technology and product challenges is how to make it so you feel like Twitter is helpful to you, not missing the information you care about in the world. And that should allow you to step away for a few hours and come back and find out what the most important stuff is.
Sounds a little bit like the mantra of a company you guys both worked for, Google, and don't be evil. I mean, that's kind of the way it rings.
It's more like be helpful.
Be helpful. Yeah. All right. Fair enough. Obviously, did a lot of research getting ready to talk to you guys. One of the things I read was in the New York Times, they had that Sunday Styles thing. They were out to dinner with you guys or whatever it was. And at the end of the piece, one of you says to the other one, and I can't remember who it was, man, you write really boring tweets.
Yeah, that was Ev to me. Yeah, he's been busting my chops for years.
Which brings up this question. Writing good tweets, and this sounds stupid, but writing good tweets is hard work.
It is.
I mean, you got 140 characters, and yeah, you can't really say a lot.
Yeah. It's an art form. Some people have really taken to it, and other people not so much. But you can tell when a tweet has been expertly crafted.
Evan Williams and Biz Stone from Twitter. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, Kai.
One more thing about that interview. Before I sat down with Ev and Biz, I can use their first names now, I tweeted a request for questions you guys would like asked. By far, the most popular one was about scalability, how to keep the service reliable as it gets bigger, something they've had problems with, and they admit that. To sum it up, in 140 characters or less, they're working on it. The whole interview is on our website, along with all our other conversations from other corner offices. The website, of course, is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an acknowledgement of the obvious as we wrap up the show from Aspen and the Ideas Festival on this Thursday. This is a place of wealth and means. Tiny condos and cottages go for seven figures or more. There are more private jets at the Aspen-Pitkin County Airport this week than you can shake a stick at, which makes it easy to dismiss what's happening here as just another chance for the economic and intellectual elite to rub elbows. And that's not a misguided critique, but there is something else, too. The chance to just step back, if only for a couple of hours, and think about the things that really matter and why. I'm pretty sure that's something you can do any place, no money or influence required. And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday. Today, the Dow rose 120 points, 1.2%. The NASDAQ up 15 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 gained 9 points, almost 0.9%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this program, the two faces of BP.
It's been thought of as a decent, well-run company with a good environmental record, a good social record, and therefore something to be proud of.
It's a different company on the other side of the pond. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.